Have you ever looked at a metric, like a number that's supposed to represent how well things are going, and just felt this profound, unsettling disconnect?
Oh, yeah, like all the time, honestly.
Right. Because I want you to picture a scenario. Imagine a local high school where, according to the state board, standardized test scores are rising, like miraculously, year over year.
Right. The charts are all going up and to the right.
Exactly. The charts look great. The administration is getting, awards for educational efficiency. But then you talk to the actual people inside that building.
The ones actually doing the work.
Yeah, the teachers. And they are burned out, just crying in their cars before first period. The students are experiencing record levels of anxiety, sleep deprivation.
It's just a completely different reality on the ground.
It is. Or think about a hospital where the What do they call it? Patient turnover efficiency rating is stellar. Revenue is through the roof.
But the nurses are literally going on strike because they're chronically exhausted.
Yes. And patients feel like they're being processed on a conveyor belt instead of actually being healed.
Just widgets on an assembly line.
Right. So you look at the official dashboard and it says total success. But you look at reality, at yourself, your community, and you just think, if we are succeeding so brilliantly, why does it feel like we are constantly running on empty?
Well, I mean, that disconnect you're describing, it isn't just some subjective feeling you're having. It certainly isn't an isolated coincidence either.
No, it feels pretty widespread.
It's actually a structural feature of how modern society measures the world. We have built these vast, incredibly complex systems that are just, they're proficient at achieving their metrics, but completely detached from the actual well-being of the living things inside them.
So we're essentially mistaking the measurement for the reality.
Exactly. We mistake the map for the territory.
And that collective civilization-wide category error is basically the entry point for our deep dive today, because modern institutions routinely mistake their own internal measures of success for genuine human and ecological flourishing.
They absolutely do.
So to figure out how we fix this, we are diving into a brand new, dense and frankly revolutionary academic white paper published literally today, August 1st, 2026.
Fresh off the presses.
Hot off the presses. It's written by Bechara Saley and it's titled Completing the Life Value Onto Axiology Program.
And I have to say, it is a phenomenal piece of scholarship. What Saley is doing here is building on the foundational philosophy of the late John McMurtry.
Right. McMurtry's work is sort of the bedrock here.
Yeah, McMurtry spent his life developing this concept called life value onto axiology, or LVOA. It is, at its core, a way of just completely reevaluating what we consider valuable in society.
So to set our mission for this deep dive, because I want to make sure we have a clear goal, McMurtry's original LVOA basically gave us a perfect compass.
That's a good way to put it.
Like it pointed true north and said, this is what actually matters. But a compass alone doesn't help you navigate like a complex modern supply chain.
No, it doesn't tell you how to get there.
Right. Or how to design a healthcare system, or even figure out why your own daily schedule is driving you into the ground. A compass tells you direction, but it doesn't give you a steering wheel, an engine, or a map of the terrain.
And that is exactly what this new white paper provides. It gives us that operational architecture.
The actual
Yeah,
mechanics.
the grammar and the mechanics to actually use that compass across economics, education, governance, and just our daily lives.
So our mission today is to decode this incredibly dense, brilliant architecture so you, listening right now, can use it as a shortcut to being a truly well-informed critical thinker.
It's going to be a fun one.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this because once you understand this framework, it permanently alters the way you view literally everything around you.
You really can't unsee it.
You really can't. So to start us off, what exactly is the baseline here? If we are throwing out standard metrics, what is this compass actually pointing toward?
Well, it points toward what McMurtry called the primary axiom. This is the bedrock of the entire framework, and we really have to get this definition right.
Okay, let's hear it.
The axiom states that value is anything that enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, felt being, and action.
Okay, wait.
And conversely, disvalue is the unnecessary reduction, disablement, or destruction of those fields.
A more coherently inclusive range of thought, felt being, and action. I mean, that is a dense string of
It's
words.
very academic, yeah.
I want to break that down because at first glance, it sounds a little utopian, maybe.
It does, but it's actually highly rigorous. Notice what isn't in that definition. It isn't just about mere survival.
Right, survival isn't the bar.
No, because, I mean, a parasite survives.
Yep.
A highly aggressive tumor survives and grows. An empire can survive for centuries by brutally dominating its neighbors.
Sure, that's true.
But life value is about the quality, the range, and the inclusion of living capacities. Coherently inclusive means my development of capacity, my growth, my wealth, my health. It shouldn't rely on destroying yours.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, or liquidating the ecological conditions we both rely on. It demands a coherence where life actually enables more life.
Okay, that makes sense. I can see how that shifts the paradigm. Because if I want to maximize my action, let's say I want to build a massive factory to produce goods, I might increase my personal capacity and my wealth.
You're doing great personally.
Yeah, my dashboard is green. But if that factory dumps toxins into the local watershed, severely reducing the health and physical capacities of the town downstream, that is a net reduction in the inclusive range of thought, felt being, and action.
Exactly.
Therefore, under this axiom, it is objectively disvalue, regardless of how much money the factory makes.
Precisely. And that brings us to the core conflict the paper identifies. Because to make this actionable, Saley contrasts two fundamentally opposed sequences of value that really dictate how human beings organize themselves.
Okay, let's get into the sequences.
The first one is the life sequence.
Let's lay out the mechanics of that. The paper uses a sort of mathematical formula for it, right? It's L leading to the means of life, leading to L to the power of one, or L prime.
Think of it as a cycle of enrichment. So you start with L, which is life itself, a living organism, a community, whatever.
Okay, L is life.
Right. And that living entity interacts with the means of life.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things we actually need to flourish. So clean water, nutritious food, secure shelter, education, caregiving, breathable air.
The actual stuff that keeps us going.
Yeah. And by utilizing those means, you arrive at L prime, which is a more capable, flourishing, resilient state of life. So life serves life, utilizing resources to expand living capacity.
Okay, so a community takes raw materials, they build a library, and the result is a more educated, connected community. The goal was the upgraded life, the L prime.
Exactly.
But then we contrast that with what the paper calls the money sequence, which is essentially the operating system of the entire global economy.
Sadly, yes.
And the formula for that one is M leading to C leading to M prime.
Right. So in the money sequence, the starting point isn't life at all. It's money, or M. You take that money and invest it in commodities, labor, and nature, which is the C in the middle.
The C is commodities.
Right. But in this sequence, human labor and ecological resources aren't valued for their intrinsic life properties. They're merely instrumental inputs.
They're just ingredients.
Exactly. The sole sovereign goal of the whole process is to multiply those inputs into M prime, which is just more money claims than you started with.
And here is where the structural pathology of our era becomes undeniable, I think. Because the paper argues that society begins to literally break down when the money sequence is treated as the ultimate sovereign goal.
It becomes the only thing that matters.
Right. And the conditions required for life are treated as just expendable inputs, or what economists love to call externalities.
That word does a lot of heavy lifting.
It really does. When we prioritize M prime, a massive inversion of reality occurs.
It is a complete cognitive distortion. When the multiplication of money is the only recognized metric of success, price becomes synonymous with value.
Right.
The pure volume of economic throughput becomes our definition of societal welfare. Think about the education example you used earlier.
The high school with the stressed teachers.
Yeah. When a school system is infected by this inversion, the actual expansion of a child's cognitive and emotional capacities, which is the life sequence, that becomes entirely secondary.
It's an afterthought.
The primary goal becomes the mere accumulation of credentials to just signal value in a labor market. The metric completely eclipses the reality. LVOA is designed to act as a corrective lens for this inversion.
Okay, while I was reading this, I kept trying to visualize a system where the metrics are perfect, but the reality is catastrophic.
Like a real-world example.
Yeah, like an analogy. Imagine a massive modern suspension bridge. It has a state-of-the-art toll plaza.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
The computers track every single car, the revenue is perfectly optimized, and the toll company's stock is just soaring. Mm-hmm. The dashboard for the money sequence is flawless.
Perfect M prime.
Right. But underneath, the steel girders are rusting, the concrete is cracking under the stress of these overloaded trucks, and the structural integrity is failing.
The physical reality is collapsing.
Yes. The toll operators are celebrating record profits while the bridge is literally vibrating itself to pieces. The toll revenue is the money sequence.
Uh-uh.
But the physical integrity of the bridge and the safety of the people on it, That is the life sequence.
That is a much more accurate way to look at it than the standard dashboard analogies. Because in your bridge example, the very thing generating the revenue, the overloaded trucks, is the exact mechanism destroying the foundation.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't even think about that layer of it.
It's true. And the tragedy of modern institutional management is that we train entire generations of professionals whose sole job is to optimize the toll plaza.
They don't even look under the bridge.
They are structurally blinded to the rust on the girders. So when the bridge finally collapses, they view it as an unpredictable anomaly.
A black swan event.
Exactly. Rather than the inevitable mathematical result of prioritizing the money sequence over the life sequence.
Okay, so we have the compass. We know we need to prioritize the structural integrity of life over the toll revenue.
Right.
But if we want to actually assess that structural integrity, we need to know what a bridge is made of to keep the metaphor going. We have to define the fundamental ground of what life actually is and what it needs to survive before we can measure whether it is flourishing or decaying.
Which is a tall order.
Yeah.
But this is where Sally introduces what he calls the minimal operational grammar.
The operational grammar.
Because if we don't have a precise shared vocabulary for what life is, we just get bogged down in endless philosophical debates. So the paper establishes a foundational ontological distinction, which is the relationship between unity, structure, and medium.
Okay, let me see if I can translate this, because the academic phrasing here can get incredibly dense.
It really can.
So a unity is the living entity itself, right? Like a human being, a honeybee, an oak tree.
Correct.
But this unity isn't just a static object, like a rock. It has a structure, which would be the internal self-regenerating components, my organs, my nervous system, my cellular processes.
Yeah, the internal mechanics.
Right. And none of that can exist in a vacuum. It is completely, continually dependent on its medium, which is the surrounding environment. So the oxygen, the social community, the bacterial biome, the gravitational field.
That is an excellent translation, honestly. You cannot separate the unity from its medium. And this triad unity, structure, medium, it is crucial because it actively prevents us from falling into two very dangerous ideological traps.
What kind of traps? Because I feel like we fall into ideological traps all the time.
We do. And the first one is extreme individualism.
Okay.
If you ignore the medium and only focus on the unity and its internal structure, you start treating environmental or systemic harms as personal moral failings.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Yeah. Imagine a person living in a highly polluted industrial town who develops chronic respiratory disease.
Mm.
An individualist, purely biomedical framework,
looks
only at their internal structure, their lungs, and perhaps blames their health choices.
They didn't exercise enough. They didn't eat right.
Right. Or they just view it as an isolated biological glitch. It completely ignores that the medium, the air quality determined by the local factory, is actively dismantling their biology.
Ah, right. So you prescribe an inhaler and tell them to exercise more, completely ignoring the toxic cloud outside their window. That is a perfect example of treating a systemic failure as an individual defect.
Exactly. It happens constantly. But on the flip side, if you only focus on the medium, you fall into a completely different trap, a vague deterministic holism.
A deterministic holism.
Yeah, you basically view everything as just a giant interconnected web where individual agency disappears.
Like everything is society's fault.
Right. If everything is just the environment's fault, then personal responsibility, individual resilience, and specific biological interventions, they just lose their meaning. LVUA forces us to hold all three, the person, their internal biological reality, and their environmental context, in constant tension.
Okay, so because of this unbreakable dependence on the medium, living beings have what the paper terms objective need.
Yes, and this is vital.
I want to linger on this because in everyday conversation, we use the words need, want, and desire completely interchangeably. Like, I need a coffee, I need a vacation.
Right, we blur the lines.
But Salaly draws a hard, undeniable line here. The definition is, a condition is objectively necessary when its absence, excess, or mistiming predictably causes a loss of life, capacity, or regenerative margin.
And the operative word there is predictably. Objective need is not a matter of opinion, and it is entirely divorced from conscious desire.
This is such a critical distinction.
Yeah.
Because a person can have an objective biological need for a specific nutrient, say vitamin C, to prevent scurvy without ever consciously desiring an orange.
Exactly. You don't have to want the vitamin for your body to need it.
Conversely, just because my brain generates an intense burning desire for a fifth cup of coffee at 4.0 EPM or, I don't know, a brand new luxury car to impress my neighbors, it doesn't mean those things are objective life necessities.
Obviously not.
Right. If I don't get the luxury car, I might feel disappointed. But I don't suffer a predictable loss of living capacity. My organs don't shut down because I bought a used Honda.
No, they don't. And this strips away the illusion that the market simply gives people what they want.
Ah, that old excuse.
Right. Because the money sequence is brilliant at manufacturing intense desires for things we don't objectively need, while simultaneously restricting access to the things we actually do need, simply because necessity doesn't always generate the highest profit margin.
That is so true.
But there's a deeper philosophical bridge here that the paper addresses.
Yeah.
Because how does a purely biological need translate into a conscious feeling? Selle outlines a four-level sequence of meaning to explain how a physical event in the medium becomes an experience that a human being actually cares about.
I found this sequence incredibly helpful for grounding the philosophy. Let's walk through an example. Let's say I'm out for a hike, and I've been walking for hours without food.
Okay, the first level of meaning is purely physical difference. In your case, the physical reality is that the glycogen stores in your liver are depleting and your blood sugar is dropping.
So just the raw chemistry?
Yes.
Yes.
It is a measurable change in your internal chemistry.
So level one is physical difference. Level two is functional significance. This means that the physical drop in blood sugar isn't just an isolated event. It threatens my viability as a living organism.
It matters to the system.
Right. My body has to react to maintain homeostasis, so it has biological meaning before I even have a conscious thought about it.
Precisely. Your biological structure recognizes the threat, which leads to level three, which is felt valence.
Felt valence. Okay.
In sentient creatures with nervous systems, that functional significance is translated into an internal subjective experience. In this case, you feel the sensation of hunger, fatigue, or perhaps a headache.
Oh, I definitely get the headache.
Right. It registers as a negative felt valence discomfort that compels action.
And finally, level four is interpretive meaning. This is where my highly evolved human brain takes that raw sensation of hunger and wraps it in memory, culture, and language.
You start telling a story about it.
Right. I don't just feel an ache. I think, I should have packed a protein bar. I wonder how far the car is. I hope my hiking partner isn't annoyed that I need to stop. I turn the biological signal into a public, debatable reason.
Exactly.
Okay, let me pause and push back on something here, because my mind immediately goes to the philosophical implications. When we talk about level three felt valence, we are talking about subjective experience, pain, pleasure, fatigue. Does this framework claim to have cracked the hard problem of consciousness?
The hard problem, yeah.
Because neuroscientists and philosophers have spent centuries arguing over why a chemical reaction in the brain produces an internal feeling at all. If I'm stressed at my job, the biological reality might be cortisol flooding my system. But why does that translate into the crushing subjective feeling of anxiety? Is the paper trying to answer that?
That is a very sophisticated critique, and the answer is the definitive no.
Good.
Yeah. Serle explicitly states that the metaphysical hard problem of consciousness remains unresolved, and more importantly, that LVOA doesn't need to resolve it to be valid.
That feels like a huge relief. I was worried we were about to veer into some grand unified theory of the universe that tries to explain away the mystery of the human soul with a biological equation.
No, not at all. It relies on a highly pragmatic, relational theory of sense-making. The framework essentially says, we may not know the exact quantum or metaphysical mechanism of how physical matter generates subjective awareness. However, we empirically know that it does.
We know we feel things.
Right. We know that pain hurts. We know that joy is pleasant. And we objectively know the biological and social conditions required to sustain the physical capacities that allow those experiences to exist.
I really appreciate that approach, because I don't need a PhD in theoretical physics to know that dropping a brick on my foot is a bad idea.
It's objectively a bad idea.
We can measure the tissue damage, and we can acknowledge the reality of the pain without having to perfectly map the genesis of consciousness itself.
Exactly. LVOA's ethical criterion just requires acknowledging that the felt side of being is real, it has weight, and it is directly impacted, nourished, or severely damaged by how we structure our economic and social systems.
Well, if we accept that needs are objective, and that they translate into very real subjective suffering when unmet, we run into a massive problem with our current societal vocabulary.
How so?
Because we constantly confuse what we desire with what we need. And worse, we confuse the products the market sells us with actual solutions to our needs.
Oh, absolutely.
And to navigate this, the paper introduces an operational grammar, specifically a taxonomy of satisfiers.
This might be the most immediately applicable part of the entire paper for daily life.
I think so, too.
We tend to operate on a very simplistic binary. I have a need, I consume a product, the need is satisfied. But Saheli breaks satisfiers down into five distinct categories based on their actual verifiable outcomes rather than their marketing labels.
I want to spend some real time on these because they perfectly explain why modern life feels so exhausting.
Let's do it.
The first category is the genuine satisfier. This is the gold standard. A genuine satisfier actually meets the objective need and builds or restores capacity without causing some massive displaced harm.
A classic example in healthcare would be accessible, high-quality primary care. If you have early-stage hypertension, a genuine satisfier is a doctor who helps you adjust your lifestyle, prescribes necessary medication, and monitors your progress, thereby preventing a stroke and strengthening your capacity to live fully.
Straightforward enough. Real problem, real solution. But then we step down to the partial satisfier. This addresses one aspect of the need, but leaves other critical dimensions completely unresolved.
Emergency food relief is a pretty sobering example of this.
Okay, how so?
If someone is starving, a food bank provides a partial satisfier. It meets the immediate biological need for calories today, which is obviously vital.
Right.
But it does absolutely nothing to resolve the underlying lack of food security, the lack of stable income, or the need for consistent nutritional quality. It stabilizes the crisis without solving the need.
Okay, I see. Which brings us to the more insidious categories. The third type is the pseudo-satisfier.
These are everywhere.
Right. A pseudo-satisfier produces the subjective feeling or the psychological signal of satisfaction, but it objectively fails to resolve the underlying need. In fact, it often masks the decay of the capacity.
Can you think of an example from everyday life?
Oh, definitely. Social media is the ultimate weaponized pseudo-satisfier.
A perfect example.
Let's say you have an objective human need for social connection and belonging. You feel lonely. That's the felt valence we talked about.
The signal.
Right. Instead of engaging in a genuine satisfier like meeting a friend or joining a community group, you open an app and start doom scrolling.
And what happens biologically?
The app is engineered to give your brain tiny microdoses of dopamine. A like on a photo, a funny video, a controversial comment. It hijacks the reward circuitry of your brain.
So you feel connected.
You feel a temporary, fleeting signal of connection, but objectively, you are sitting alone in a dark room. The pseudo-satisfier tricks your brain into thinking the need is being met, but over time, your actual social capacity and your real-world relationships atrophy. It generates the illusion of satisfaction while deepening the actual isolation.
That is a brilliant breakdown of the mechanism. And notice how perfectly the pseudo-satisfier aligns with the money sequence we discussed earlier.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because if a company sells you a genuine satisfier, say they teach you how to cultivate deep, lasting friendships, they might make a small profit once. You don't need them anymore.
Right. I'm satisfied.
But if they provide a pseudo-satisfier, one that constantly triggers the desire but never actually quenches the thirst, you become a permanent consumer. You keep coming back, endlessly generating ad revenue and data. The money sequence thrives precisely because the life sequence is failing.
That is incredibly dark. And it gets worse with the fourth category, the inhibiting satisfier.
Yeah, these are tough.
This meets one genuine need, but it does so in a way that actively obstructs or destroys other necessary capacities.
We see this often in public policy. Imagine a community demanding a sense of physical security. The state responds by installing massive, overwhelming surveillance cameras on every corner, facial recognition, militarized patrols.
Okay, so crime drops.
It might actually suppress street crime, meeting the immediate need for physical safety, but it acts as an inhibiting satisfier because it systematically disables trust, privacy, freedom of movement, and democratic participation.
Wow.
It solves one need by amputating several others.
And then there's the final boss of terrible solutions. The counter-satisfier. This is a mechanism that claims to meet a need, but structurally ensures that the original need will become exponentially worse over time. It creates cumulative dependence and harm.
The predatory payday loan industry is the quintessential counter-satisfier.
Walk me through that one.
Okay, a person has an objective need for basic sustenance. They need to buy groceries to feed their family. They lack the funds, so they take out a payday loan with a, 400% interest rate.
Right. It provides the cash today, so the immediate need for food is met.
Yes, but the structure of the loan guarantees that a massive portion of their future income will be confiscated to service the debt. By solving the acute crisis today, it mathematically guarantees a more severe state of chronic dispossession tomorrow. The satisfier is the very engine creating future deprivation.
That's horrifying. When you lay it out like this, genuine, partial, pseudo-inhibiting, and counter-satisfiers, you realize that we live in an economy heavily optimized for the last three.
We really do.
A pharmaceutical company pushing highly addictive painkillers rather than funding physical therapy is selling a counter-satisfier. An economy built on endless, cheap, disposable consumer goods that clutter our homes and pollute our oceans is just a civilization-scale pseudo-satisfier.
Which is why having this grammar is so powerful. It gives you the language to look at a booming industry and say, yes, they are generating billions in the money sequence, but they are doing it by systematically deploying counter-satisfiers that degrade our life sequence.
But I'm looking at this and thinking, okay, let's say I audit my life. I cut out the social media pseudo-satisfiers. I avoid the debt trap counter-satisfiers. I seek out a genuine satisfier. Say, I find a fantastic community garden that provides healthy food and social connection. Problem solved, right?
If only we're that static. But no, the presence of a genuine satisfier doesn't guarantee flourishing if you don't have consistent access to it. A hospital might be a genuine satisfier, but if you can't afford the treatment, or if the waitlist is 6 months long, its mere existence doesn't help you.
Right. I have to be able to actually use it. This forces a shift in how we think about time and movement.
Nice.
Which brings us to section 4 of the paper, exploring why the dynamic process of flow matters infinitely more than static stocks. The paper maps out a causal sequence. It starts with the need, moves to the satisfier, which requires a provision flow, leading to access and assimilation, which enables regulation, building capacity, and margin, ultimately determining your viability trajectory.
It sounds like a lot of academic jargon, I know.
It's a mouthful.
But it's actually a beautiful description of how biology and society function in real time. We have a very bad habit in our culture of measuring wealth, health, and security in static snapshots.
Yeah.
We look at stocks.
Like stockpiles.
Right. We measure how much money is sitting in a bank account, how many MRI machines a hospital owns, or how many college graduates a city has. We treat these static accumulations as evidence of success.
But Serhelyi argues that stocks are essentially just the stabilized histories of flows.
Exactly. Life is not a static state. It is an active, continuous, temporally patterned process. Consider the most basic biological need, hydration. You can have a stock of 1 million gallons of fresh water stored in a reservoir. That is a massive stock of a genuine satisfier.
Plenty of water.
But if that water is not flowing into your body through a regular, accessible daily rhythm, you will die of thirst right next to the reservoir. Quantity, timing, rhythm, accessibility, these are the grammatical rules of flow.
I can see how this applies to almost everything. Muscles atrophy without a consistent flow of physical movement. You can't just exercise for a month, build a stock of muscle, and then sit on the couch for a year expecting to keep it.
The stock decays without the flow.
A democratic institution rots without a consistent flow of transparency and accountability.
And when a system provides the right flow of genuine satisfiers, it generates the most crucial concept in this entire framework. Margin. Serhelyi provides a formal scaffold equation for this that should fundamentally alter how we view productivity. The equation is margin equals capacity minus load, M equals CL.
Let me take a swing at explaining this one because this hits so close to home for anyone working in a modern corporate environment.
Please do.
Capacity is the maximum amount of energetic, cognitive, or physical resources a person or a system has available. Load is the total weight of the demands placed upon them. The work tasks, the emotional stress, the biological stressors like poor sleep or illness.
Right.
If my maximum cognitive capacity for the day is represented by the number 10, and my job, my commute, and my family responsibilities put a load of 8 on me, I have a margin of 2.
That is precisely it. But how does our current work culture view that margin of 2?
Oh, modern management theory looks at that margin of 2 and calls it inefficiency.
Yes.
It calls it wasted potential. If I have a capacity of 10 and load of 8, my boss will find a way to give me 2 more projects so my load hits 10. Perfect efficiency. Zero wasted resources.
And mathematically, under the LVOA framework, what happens when margin equals 0?
The system becomes incredibly brittle. If my capacity is 10 and my load is 10, my margin is exactly 0. I am functioning, but I am redlining.
You're at the absolute limit.
If one unexpected thing happens, if I catch a cold, if my car breaks down, if a project deadline shifts, my load spikes to 12. But my capacity is capped at 10. The result is structural failure. I burn out, I get sick, I drop the ball.
This is a profound insight into biological and institutional resilience. Margin is not laziness. Margin is not a luxury. Margin is the biological and structural reserve required for adaptation, for recovery, for immune response, and for learning.
So when institutions optimize for zero margin...
When they optimize for zero margin in the name of efficiency, whether it's just-in-time supply chains, skeleton crew staffing in hospitals, or hyper-competitive grading in schools, they are engineering inevitable collapse.
And the paper introduces an action triad based on this reality, emphasizing that we have to be face-sensitive in how we manage people and systems. The triad is stabilize, repair, develop.
This directly challenges the constant demand for growth.
Because you can't just grow all the time.
No. If a system or a person is operating with zero margin or a negative margin, you cannot immediately demand that they develop. If a student is traumatized, sleep-deprived, and chronically stressed, pushing them to master advanced calculus-demanding development will actually cause neurological harm.
You have to follow the lexical order. First, you must stabilize, stop the active bleeding, remove the crushing load, provide safety.
Stabilize the system.
Once stabilized, you must focus on repair, allowing the body and mind to heal, restoring the capacity that was damaged by the chronic overload.
Right.
Only when the system has repaired itself and generated a surplus margin is it safe and beneficial to introduce the challenge of development. Pushing a zero margin system to develop is like trying to accelerate a car that has no oil and blown out tires.
And yet, that is the exact operating procedure for much of our global economy and educational systems. We demand infinite development from depleted, zero-margin populations and ecosystems.
I see the logic here, deeply. But I have to say, if we try to apply this equation, margin equals capacity minus load, to the entirety of society, things are going to get chaotic.
Or messy, yeah.
Because on a societal level, resources are often distributed in a way where one specific group hoards all the capacity and margin while pushing all the load onto another group. How on earth do we make policy decisions when interests inevitably collide?
That is the central political challenge of any civilization, honestly. And Soheili directly addresses it with what he calls the decision procedure. To navigate these collisions, the paper introduces a proposed operational corollary. An apparent gain is not a net life value gain if it depends upon the avoidable, equal, or greater loss of necessary life conditions or margins elsewhere.
Okay, this is the rule of non-compensation. It means we have to stop averaging out human suffering against financial windfalls.
Exactly. Under traditional cost-benefit analysis, if a tech monopoly increases its valuation by $50 billion, but its business practices destroy the main street economies of 10,000 small towns and push a million workers into precarious gig labor with zero margin,
the economists cheer.
Right. Economists will often look at the aggregate GDP, see that it went up, and declare the policy a net success. The financial gain mathematically compensated for the human loss.
But LVOA says absolutely not. You cannot justify severe losses to foundational life necessities by pointing to aggregate gains in unrelated, often financial areas. A billionaire buying a third mega yacht does not cancel out a community losing access to clean drinking water.
To enforce this, LVOA provides a lexical ordering for decisions. Lexical means you cannot skip steps. You must satisfy the first condition before you can even consider the second.
Sort of like a hierarchy of needs for policy.
Exactly. The very first steps are protect necessity floors, prevent irreversible capacity loss, restore damaged capacities.
Secure the biological and ecological baseline first. Make sure everyone can breathe, eat, and have shelter, and make sure the ecosystems providing those things aren't collapsing.
Yes, and the paper explicitly notes that only after these absolute life requirements are met across the board should a society even begin to compare traditional efficiency, cost savings, or monetary return. The money sequence is subordinate to the life sequence.
To actually implement this, the paper proposes a mechanism called the anti-displacement test.
It is a diagnostic tool for finding nested failures. When assessing any new policy, product, or institution, the test forces us to ask, who is actually receiving the benefit, who is quietly bearing the increased load, and which ecosystems are being consumed to balance the ledger.
Okay, I have to pause and push back on this because while it sounds ethically perfect, it feels practically paralyzing.
I get that.
I want you to think about my daily life. If I need a new t-shirt and I go to a big box store and buy one for $5, the anti-displacement test asks me to calculate the hidden load. I know intellectually that this $5 shirt probably displaced a massive burden onto a garment worker in a developing nation who is working 14-hour days with zero margin.
Probably, yes.
And it displaced an ecological load onto a river that was polluted with fabric dye. But does this framework demand omniscience from me as a consumer?
No, it doesn't.
Am I supposed to personally audit the entire global supply chain every time I buy a pair of socks? Because if it demands that, it's just going to induce guilt and paralysis. We wouldn't be able to function.
I think that's a very common and valid fear when confronted with systemic ethics. But if we pull back a layer and look at the paper's intent, Saley anticipates this exact critique. The framework explicitly states that nested analysis must avoid paralysis. It acknowledges that no action in a complex world is totally consequence-free, and complete information is a physical impossibility.
So it doesn't expect me to be an omniscient saint.
Not at all. The standard it sets is reasonable scope proportional to the stakes. If you are a citizen buying a t-shirt, your scope is limited.
You can only know so much.
Right. But if you are a multinational corporation designing the supply chain for 100 million t-shirts, your proportional responsibility is massive. The framework isn't designed to maximize individual consumer guilt. It is designed to mandate institutional design.
Okay, that makes way more sense. The failure isn't just my purchase. The structural failure is that the global economy was legally and economically designed to intentionally hide those displaced burdens from me.
So that the money sequence could operate without friction.
Exactly.
Precisely. LVOA demands that our institutions create channels and mechanisms to make these previously invisible consequences visible and actionable. The burden of proof shifts. The corporation should have to prove they aren't displacing fatal loads, rather than the consumer having to play detective.
That is a huge relief, but it naturally leads to the next massive question. If our current institutions, our corporations and governments, are largely built to hide these displacements in service of M Prime, what kind of institutions do we actually need to build?
This is where we move into institutional realization. The paper introduces two vital concepts that redefine how we govern ourselves: life capital and civil commons.
I found the term life capital fascinating because it reclaims a word capital that has been almost entirely co-opted by finance.
It reclaims it by returning to its roots. Life capital is defined as organized wealth that reproduces life goods and capacities through time without causing cumulative net life loss.
So we are talking about tangible and social realities. A population of healthy bodies is life capital. Strong caregiving relationships, a robust public health infrastructure, fertile topsoil, clean aquifers, deep social trust within a community. These are the true wealth of a nation.
Contrast that with how the money sequence views capital. Let's use the example of an old growth forest. Under our current economic paradigm, if a massive timber corporation clear cuts that entire ancient forest, destroys the habitat, and sells the lumber,
the financial system registers that as a massive generation of capital. GDP goes up. The corporate balance sheet looks incredibly healthy.
But LVOA exposes the massive accounting error happening there.
How so?
Well, it isn't capital creation. It is capital liquidation. They are destroying the biological engine, the life capital of the forest, the watershed, the carbon sink, to create a short-term static spike in monetary claims. They are liquidating the conditions of future life for immediate profit. To prevent this liquidation, society must build and defend what the paper calls civil commons.
Let's define civil commons because it sounds similar to public goods, but there's a nuanced difference. The paper defines them as social arrangements that secure universal access to life goods based strictly on objective need rather than purchasing power.
That is the key distinction. In a market system, access is determined by your ability to pay. In a civil commons, access is determined by your biological or social requirement to function.
So things like universal health care.
Yes, a universal health care system, accessible public libraries, a clean municipal water system. These are provisioning organs designed specifically to protect and reproduce life capital, shielding it from the logic of the money sequence.
But the paper isn't naive about government institutions. It includes a strong warning that just slapping a public good label on a bureaucracy doesn't give it a free pass.
Definitely not.
Civil commons have to be rigorously tested. They can be captured by bureaucratic inertia, they can be corrupted by commercial lobbying, or they can become exclusionary, serving only a privileged subset of the public.
Like a water system is a civil commons until the pipes corrode with lead and the government tries to cover it up to save money. At that point, it has failed the life value test.
To prevent that kind of capture, Saley proposes a new overarching layer, the life knowledge commons. This is envisioned as a publicly accessible, transparent, and constantly contestable knowledge infrastructure. It is meant to govern the application of this very framework.
Right, because if this philosophy becomes a closed dogma controlled by an elite group of technocrats, it becomes a new kind of tyranny. The paper stresses that no single individual, government, or artificial intelligence should ever become the absolute sovereign interpreter of LVOA. It has to remain an open democratic process.
If we successfully build these institutions, if we prioritize life capital through civil commons, we inevitably have to completely redefine our concept of efficiency.
I was waiting for this, because right now efficiency just means cutting costs. It means doing things faster, cheaper, with fewer people. If a company fires half its staff and forces the remaining half to work 80 hours a week with zero margin, Wall Street calls that an incredible leap in operational efficiency.
Under LVOA, that definition is obsolete. Efficiency is no longer the ratio of monetary output to monetary input. True, life coherent efficiency is the production and distribution of genuine life goods with diminishing waste, diminishing harm, and diminishing burden displacement over time.
Meaning, a healthcare system is efficient not when it processes patients the fastest with the cheapest drugs, but when it restores the maximum amount of human capacity while inflicting the minimum amount of stress on its nurses and the minimum amount of toxic waste into the environment.
Exactly. But if we redefine efficiency that radically, we have a massive epistemological problem. How do we actually know if a system is efficient? How do we measure human flourishing without just creating a new, equally flawed spreadsheet? What counts as evidence?
This was my favorite part of the methodology. The paper argues that we cannot rely on just one type of data. It proposes three mutually correcting standpoints of evidence: first person, second person, and third person. Let's dig into how these interact, because this solves so many blind spots in modern science and policy.
We can use your hospital example to illustrate this perfectly. Let's define the standpoints first. Third person evidence is objective, external, and quantifiable data. In medicine, this is your blood pressure reading, your white blood cell count, an MRI scan, or epidemiological statistics. It is the view from the outside.
And traditionally, this is the only evidence the system truly respects. But LVOA insists on the equal validity of first-person evidence. This is the lived, subjective experience of the individual. It's the felt valence we discussed earlier. A patient's pain, their crushing fatigue, the psychological barriers they face, the meaning they derive from their life.
And second-person evidence acts as the vital bridge between the two. This is testimony, dialogue, caregiving, and participatory interpretation. It's the interaction where the doctor listens to the patient and contextualizes the data.
Let's see what happens when these get out of balance. Let's say a patient with a chronic illness goes to a specialist. The doctor focuses entirely on third-person evidence. They look at the chart. The lab results show that the inflammatory markers are back within a normal range. The doctor declares the treatment a massive, highly efficient success.
But the doctor is ignoring the first-person reality.
Exactly. The patient is sitting on the exam table saying, "Doctor, I can barely get out of bed. I am overwhelmingly fatigued. I can't concentrate on my work, and I have zero margin in my daily life." If the medical system privileges the third-person metric over the first-person reality, it normalizes the patient's suffering. It misclassifies a functional failure as a clinical success. The chart is healthy, but the human being is still disabled.
That happens every single day in clinics around the world, and it is a direct result of epistemological arrogance. The metric blinds the system to reality. However, the paper is equally rigorous in the opposite direction. Privileging first-person certainty without third-person testing is also incredibly dangerous.
This is where we get into the realm of pseudoscience. Let's say I feel terribly ill, and I start taking a completely unproven herbal supplement. 2 weeks later, I feel fantastic. My first-person evidence tells me with absolute certainty that the supplement cured me.
But without rigorous third-person testing, without clinical trials, control groups, and biomarker tracking, you might be mistaking a complete biological coincidence for causality. You might have just recovered naturally, or perhaps you experienced a powerful placebo effect. If you use your subjective experience to tell 1,000 other people to abandon their medical treatments for this herb, you are actively destroying life capacity.
So the brilliance is that the three standpoints are mutually correcting. The labs verify the feelings contextualize the labs, and the dialogue connects them.
And to give this real scientific teeth, Sonley incorporates some very advanced contemporary biological theories into this epistemological framework. Specifically, he relies on the concept of allostatic load developed by Bruce McEwen and the theory of predictive regulation by Peter Stirling.
Okay, we need to unpack those terms. What is allostatic load?
We mentioned earlier how a zero-margin lifestyle causes damage. Allostatic load is the biological mechanism of that damage. Imagine a worker in a highly precarious job, say, a gig economy delivery driver, constantly worried about making rent. Their brain, using predictive regulation, anticipates the stress and signals the adrenal system to release cortisol and adrenaline to deal with the threat.
It's the fight or flight response, but prolonged indefinitely.
Exactly. When the load is continuous and there is zero margin for repair, these highly toxic stress hormones never clear from the system. Over years, this chronic chemical bath actively degrades the cardiovascular system, shrinks areas of the brain involved in memory, and suppresses the immune system. This cumulative biological wear and tear is the allostatic load.
And the terrifying thing is, for the first 5 years of this process, third-person metrics like a routine physical might show nothing wrong. The worker's blood pressure might be fine today, but the allostatic load is quietly rotting the structural girders of their biology. If we don't integrate their first-person testimony of chronic stress, we won't see the damage until they have a massive heart attack at age 45.
Which perfectly illustrates why LVOA demands a transformation in how we evaluate our core domains. The paper provides a matrix for how this framework changes our institutional goals. In healthcare, we have to transition away from merely tracking treatment volume, disease codes, and profit margins. We must reorient the entire system toward tracking restored function, subjective agency, and the expansion of the patient's margin.
It applies everywhere. In education, we have to move away from treating students as metric-generating machines. We need to stop tracking mere attendance and standardized test credentials and start measuring whether we are providing safe developmental conditions, fostering a sense of meaning, and actually expanding cognitive capacity without inflicting allostatic load.
In economics, it demands the end of GDP as a proxy for success. A rising GDP that relies on liquidating the biosphere is a pathology, not an achievement. We must measure the growth of regenerative life capital and ensure that sufficiency floors are met for every citizen.
And in governance, we shift from measuring mere procedural compliance, did we follow the bureaucratic rules, to the active participatory detection of life harms within the community. It is a breathtakingly massive scope. It touches every single facet of human organization.
It is ambitious, arguably the most ambitious systemic framework since the mid-20th century, which naturally makes me highly skeptical. Because history is littered with brilliant, comprehensive theories that promised to fix the world and instead mutated into rigid authoritarian cults or were instantly co-opted and gamed by the very corrupt systems they were trying to replace. What is to stop LVOA from becoming just another failed utopia?
Sis Haley is acutely aware of this danger. In fact, he dedicates the final section of the paper entirely to identifying the risks of the framework and establishing constitutional safeguards against its corruption.
Let's look at the philosophical risks first. Critics will inevitably point out the naturalistic fallacy.
Yes. The classic philosophical argument from David Hume, you cannot derive an ought from an is. Critics might argue just because biological systems require certain flows and margins to survive, an objective is, doesn't mean we have a moral obligation to provide them an ought. Biology does not equal morality.
How does LVOA defend against that?
By pointing out that the critique misses the foundation of ethics. LVOA doesn't claim that biology is morality. It points out that moral agency, the ability to think, debate, make ethical choices, and participate in society, requires biological conditions to exist. You cannot have a high-minded debate about moral obligations with someone who is currently suffocating or starving. By securing the biological is, you make the ethical ought possible.
That is a very solid defense. There's also the risk of anthropocentrism. If we focus so much on human flourishing, human meaning, and human civil commons, don't we just end up paving over the rest of the natural world to serve our own needs?
The framework explicitly guards against this. Remember the ontological ground. Unity, structure, medium. Humanity's medium is the planetary biosphere. LVOA asserts that non-human life has intrinsic standing. Ecosystems are not just instrumental resources to be optimally managed for human consumption. They are vital, regenerative unities in themselves. Destroying the biosphere to temporarily boost human capacity is mathematically incoherent under this axiom.
But the most practical risk, the one that I think about every day, is metric gaming. Any metric, no matter how noble, can and will be manipulated by human beings if their funding or survival depends on it. If a hospital knows they are now going to be graded on a patient regenerative margin instead of treatment volume, administrators will just find a way to manipulate the data to make it look like margin is increasing without changing the underlying care.
Goodhart's Law. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. The only safeguard against metric gaming in LVOA is radical transparency, independent auditing, and the absolute requirement of first and second person evidence. If the hospital's third-person data says margin is up, but the local patient community council, the first-person testimony says care is terrible, the system flags a structural failure. You cannot game the metric if the people living the reality have the power to veto the data.
But the ultimate danger the paper flags is what Sicali calls totalization. The danger that proponents of this theory become so convinced of its brilliance that they turn it into a closed, unassailable doctrine.
History shows us that when a theory thinks it has the final, absolute answer to the human condition, it usually ends in tragedy. To prevent this, the paper concludes with a research program that actively demands its own vulnerability. It calls for adversarial research.
I love this concept. Sicali is literally inviting researchers, economists, and philosophers who disagree with LVOA to design tests, run comparative institutional pilots, and find counterexamples to try and break his model. He is demanding empirical completion, not philosophical purity.
It is the ultimate sign of intellectual honesty. And it all culminates in a set of guiding principles he calls the methodological triality. Three rules to keep the compass pointing true north.
Let's read these out because they are incredibly powerful. Rule one, does this action, policy, or institution protect, restore, or enlarge life capacity?
Rule two is the safeguard against dogmatism. What specific evidence would genuinely force us to change our minds and admit we are wrong?
And rule three, which is perhaps the most profound piece of advice for both societal design and personal living, never fall in love with coherence more than reality.
That is the thesis of the entire paper right there.
I want to focus on that third rule for a moment. Never fall in love with coherence more than reality. Think about how deeply that applies to our everyday lives. How often do we cling to a restrictive diet or a grueling productivity hack or a political ideology because it sounds perfectly logically coherent in a book or on a podcast? It makes perfect sense on paper. But meanwhile, the reality of our lived experience, our crushing fatigue, our misery, our growing isolation, is screaming at us that the system is destroying our life margin.
We constantly prefer the clean mathematical lines of the dashboard to the messy, alarming reality of the burning car. We fall in love with the coherent metric and we ignore the reality of the degradation. This framework is a rigorous, demanding plea that we face reality in all its complexity and prioritize the actual tangible conditions that allow life to flourish.
We have covered a massive amount of conceptual ground today. We started by defining the life value compass and exposing the great inversion of the money sequence. We explored the undeniable reality of objective needs and how they translate into felt meaning.
We moved through the critical difference between genuine satisfiers and the pseudo and counter-satisfiers that dominate our economy. We saw how the dynamic flows of these satisfiers dictate our crucial biological and structural margin.
We learned why we must stabilize and repair before we demand development. We unpacked the anti-displacement test to expose the hidden costs of our convenience. And we mapped out how civil commons, guided by a triad of first, second, and third person evidence, can protect our life capital from being liquidated for profit.
It provides us with a comprehensive, actionable toolkit, not just for diagnosing the polycrisis of our modern world, but for systematically designing institutions that actually serve life, rather than just serving the endless multiplication of money claims.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, I have a specific challenge for you, the listener. I want you to take this operational grammar and run a ruthless audit on your own life this week. Look closely at the satisfiers you are constantly pursuing, the things you buy, the digital habits you formed, the way you spend your evenings. Are they genuine satisfiers that build your capacity? Or are they pseudo-satisfiers that just give you a micro dose of simulated connection while actively draining your energy? Look at your own margin equation. Are you constantly demanding development from yourself, pushing for the next promotion, the next side hustle, the next milestone, when you are operating at zero margin and desperately need a phase of stabilization and repair?
It is a deeply personal audit. But recognizing these patterns in our own lives is the first necessary step to recognizing them in our global structures.
And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought, an extrapolation that builds on everything we've discussed today. We all know that our current global digital infrastructure, the algorithms that dictate what news we see, what products we crave, and how we interact with each other, is entirely hardwired to optimize for the money sequence. It is masterfully designed to feed us endless pseudo-satisfiers to keep our eyes glued to the screen, generating data and ad revenue at the direct expense of our mental health and social cohesion. But I want you to imagine a different world. What would a digital ecosystem look like if its underlying code was rewritten using LVOA's anti-displacement test? What if an algorithm's ultimate program goal wasn't to capture your attention for financial profit, but to measurably increase your regenerative margin and then actively encourage you to log off? Imagine a technology that values your life capital more than it values your data.
That is a vision of the future that this framework finally makes imaginable.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. It has been an incredible journey through a truly paradigm-shifting piece of work. Until next time, keep questioning the metrics and always keep your eyes on the reality.